This is a CBC podcast.
CBC podcasts are supported by the all-new 2008 Cadillac CTS. When you turn your car on, does it return the favor? Visit newcadillac.gm.ca.
It's Wednesday, December 26th. The stores are open again, ready for anyone who wants to spend the day fighting over markdown stuff nobody else wanted to buy in the pre-Christmas rush. Instead of sitting at home in quiet comfort, surrounded by the people that love us. Currently, let me be the first to say, thank God. This is The Current Podcast.
Hello, I'm Anna Maria Tremonti. You're listening to The Current. At one time or another, you probably found yourself watching the news and wishing there was something, anything, you could do about a terrible tragedy unfolding half a world away. For most of us, that sentiment never quite translates into action. But not Debbie Bodkin. She is a sergeant with the Waterloo Regional Police, and a few years ago, she became so outraged by the images she was seeing of the genocide in Darfur that she packed her bags and went to the region to document the stories of people who were living through it. She has gone back again since then, and she speaks publicly in Canada about what she saw there in the hopes that her actions and the stories she's brought back might help prevent further bloodshed. In October, I spoke with Debbie Bodkin about her time working with refugees fleeing the crisis of Darfur. And I began by asking her what image came to mind when she thought of the place.
The women that I interviewed, I picture them and picture our conversations and hugging one another and how all that was.
You've gone to the region twice now and you've gone on your own time. Why did you go?
Well, initially, if you want me to sort of go back to how it began, when I went to Kosovo for 1 month through my police department. And being from a small town, southwestern Ontario, I hadn't really traveled anywhere or seen anything but our safe, wonderful Canada. And that trip changed me and made me want to do more, to go where people need help more than Canadians do. And so I put my resume on this website called Canadem, and got an email asking if I would like to go to Chad initially with the U.S. State Department. So that's sort of how it started, and I went there for the two-week mission, and maybe it's like they say, Africa got under my skin. They need so much help, and they're such wonderful people that I dealt with that I had to go back.
And you went to Chad because that's the refugees were going over the border into Chad, right?
That's right.
You went to see them.
Yes.
And, well, let's talk then about when you got there. Where were you going? What did you see? What was it like?
Well, we were told before we even started we'd be camping most of the time. So we brought all our camping gear. We couldn't stay right in the camps because there was still a lot of rapes and looting and so on going on in the camps, even though it was on the Chad side of the border. So we would camp about 20 minutes away from the camps, from the refugee camps, drive in the morning and just conduct interviews from... We'd usually start 6 or 7 in the morning and try and do about 7 interviews a day at about an hour an interview and just go tent to tent and talk to the people and hear their sad stories.
And who were you interviewing then? Was it all women?
Because a lot of the men had been killed, the majority of the camp was women and children. The U.S. State Department had asked us to cover all different tribes and to get male and female, so we had to actually look for men to interview as well, but the huge majority was women that we spoke to.
You were dealing with people who were and continued to be traumatized in ways that most of us can't even imagine. How did you get them to talk to you? Would you start a conversation?
It took some time because in their culture, women wouldn't talk about anything sexually related to a best friend even very much, let alone a strange white woman from somewhere else who is using an interpreter who's a male. They weren't able to get any female interpreters. So my interpreter was a young man about 26 years old who was from Darfur, and he was very soft-spoken, and he and I sort of, we developed a relationship fairly quickly and got along really well, and he would explain to, especially the women, that to pretend that he wasn't there, that it was just them talking to me and I was here to help them, and even though he was interpreting, they would get to the point, you know, once we started, to just look at me and forget that Mustafa was there and tell me what happened.
And what kinds of things would they tell you?
The stories were always the same. The sequence of events pretty much were identical every interview. They would be in their village. Government planes or helicopters would fly over, drop bombs. Then government vehicles would drive through, shooting at anyone who was fleeing. And then finally the Janjaweed would come in on their camels or horses and continue to kill people, conduct the rapes, kidnap the children, steal the livestock, and then eventually burn the entire village down.
It was always the same pattern?
Yep. I mean, there was always differences in the degree of torture or how many people were killed in their family and so on, but the sequence was always the same.
You say that you remember those women. Tell me about some of those women then who told you stories like that.
Well, when I do my presentation, there's, I guess, three women that sort of haunt me, I guess you would say, still. One was a young girl. I'm starting already.
It's okay.
17-year-old girl named Miriam, who, she was absolutely beautiful. She was about 6 feet tall and slim. And when she came in to be interviewed, she limped. But she kept smiling the whole time she walked in, like she just had a gorgeous smile. And which I couldn't figure out initially, and she smiled through the interview. And she proceeded to tell me how she and two girlfriends had went to gather wood outside the camp, and three men on horses, Janjaweed, attacked them. And she, her two girlfriends got away, but they kept going after her, and she kept running and running. She fell down many times. They kept telling her to lay down and take her clothes off, which she refused to do. And as I said, she's smiling as she's telling me this terrifying story. And they ended up shooting her twice in the leg, but she kept running. And then finally, the second shot or whatever, they left her for dead and left her. And she couldn't walk properly anymore, but she smiled and she said, I wasn't spoiled. So it was more important, no matter what injury, that she hadn't been raped. Because in their culture, not only is there the trauma of being raped, you're quite often ostracized by your family, by everyone. You'll never be married. No one wants you anymore. So she was just so proud that she wasn't spoiled.
Amazing. And it speaks to the ability of these women and the willingness of them to even talk to you because it carries such a stigma, what happened to them.
Absolutely. Like when I think of all the, doing my work here as a police officer in Ontario, all the treatment centers and counselors and so on that we direct women to, here and there was absolutely nothing. And yet these women would sit up strong and proud and tell me horrific details and then thank me for being there and making sure I'm okay and I'm comfortable.
And in the end, they would tell you about this, did they? How did they see themselves when they would tell you these stories? Would they blame themselves? Would they, I mean, you make the point that they're culturally, they're seen as somehow ruined.
Well, you could definitely see the shame. I think most of them that I spoke to, there's one I remember in particular, were telling me the story not for them so much, but for their children, their sisters, their, you know, the rest of their family, for to try and save them. Like they were already damaged goods themselves, but they would say, thank you for coming to my country, thank you for saving my people.
They wanted people to know what was happening to
Absolutely.
Them.
Absolutely. No one ever turned down an interview. Both trips, we were always to ask if anyone wanted to speak, and they always did.
What's it like to listen to that kind of pain, person after person after person?
When we were there and doing it, you got so caught up in the work and determined, I guess, to get as many interviews done as you could that it didn't, you didn't have time to absorb it. You just went one to another. But in the evenings when you'd be sitting with your team and we had to, you know, go over our interviews and, you know, correct some of our writings or whatever, that's when you didn't want any downtime because then you would start feeling it and absorbing it. And it wasn't, I don't think it was till I came home all the time that you really start going over what you've listened to over and over.
It's hard to talk about it now too, isn't it?
Yeah.
You said that they wanted people to know what was happening and you were there with the U.S. State Department. And based on what you and your colleagues did, it was Colin Powell, then the U.S. Secretary of State, who used the word genocide to describe what was happening. You were part of the work you were doing went into the report that made him say the word.
Exactly.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And when he said that word, how did you react?
Well, not being astute to the UN mandates and politics and so on, in my mind, I just thought, well, that's good. That means they're going to stop it. You can't let it go on. It's genocide, and they've, you know, said that to the world, so we're going to go in and do something. But obviously I was wrong.
You went back not long after.
Yeah, I came back in August 2004, and then I was contacted and asked if I would go again, this time with the United Nations, in November 2004.
Was it a hard decision to make to go back?
Not at all. Totally. I immediately wanted to go. I felt like I hadn't finished my case, which was is what it would be like if I was at work. You don't leave a case unfinished. You continue it till it's done. So no, I was immediately wanted to go. I had to get permission from my police service and so on, but I was determined to go back.
You had to take a leave of absence?
Yes.
Okay. And when you went back with the UN, what were you doing for them?
Exactly the same thing. It wasn't near as structured as it had been with the State Department. We didn't have a questionnaire. We were just told, get out there, interview as much of a cross-section of different tribal people, interview Janjaweed and some of the Arab people if they're willing to interview you, and just do as many interviews as you can, as quickly as you can.
And could you talk to the Janjaweed?
A few of them spoke to us. Some of the commissioners in charge of the investigation actually spoke to the leaders, but we did have some of the lower level leaders that would speak to us. And their stories were always different in that it wasn't horrible stories of killings and rape of family members and so on. It was a few injuries, but it was more that whatever African tribe, they would say, came to their camp and stole their livestock. That was more their
And that would be their reason issue. For attacking a village.
Yeah.
To get the... Knowing what you knew on the other side, having talked to the women who had been raped, what was it like to sit there and listen to people who, I mean, you clearly thought they were
lying.
Telling you a lie, yeah?
Absolutely. But, I mean, I've done that for 20 years through work, too. You always interview the suspect, and even though you know he's lying, you have to hear his side of the story and try and keep an open mind and, you know, get the facts. So I did the same sort of thing, as much as it would be eating me up inside when I knew they were lying, but I still had to do the interview as best I could.
What do you remember about the women who you spoke to the second time?
Same as the first time. I mean, the stories were always the same. But again, the strength of the women and the generosity and their concern for me and my safety and did I have enough food, water, whatever. And these women are starving and they're trying to feed, you know, sometimes seven children. But they were always asking me, how are you? You know, we'd finish their interview hearing these horrible stories and then they would ask my interpreter to ask me, is there anything I need or anything?
It's very humbling, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we have no idea how lucky we have it here.
You talked to a lot of women. Did you get to talk to any of their children?
Many children as well.
Tell us what you heard.
Well, the clearest one in my mind, as I said, when we first got there, we had to go and look for people to be interviewed. But within a few days, they knew where we lived. They knew where we worked. And we would have lineups waiting for us when we went to work. Or we'd go to leave our house, and we'd have people outside waiting. And one morning, we had a man and his two daughters who were waiting outside her house when we went to leave. And he had walked 3 hours with his daughters, who were 10 and 7, with no food, no water, barefoot, to get to us because he wanted his daughters to be able to speak to us. And so I was able to get my interpreter to come to the house, and we interviewed the girls there. And it was like talking to little hollow shells. They really, they weren't children anymore. They had a really vacant look in their eyes, and they just kind of told me the story of, very similar to Miriam's story, going to gather wood for firewood and being attacked by the Janjaweed, and each of them had been raped by three men. As I said, they were 10 and 7. The father had carried the 10-year-old to the interview because she couldn't walk anymore from the rapes. And then after interviewing them, the father proceeded to tell me how he found the girls bleeding out in the desert and carried them to a doctor. And at that time, the government of Sudan had put in a rule that in order to see a doctor for a rape, you had to first make a report to the police. And most of the police were hired by the government and also corrupt. So this father had taken his girls to the police department, and a female police officer had put the girls in separate rooms, and one at a time went in and told them, stop lying, stop making trouble, or you're going to cause harm to the rest of your family, so just stop it and get out of here, and kick them out and refuse to give them a report. So
extraordinary, yeah.
Yeah, the father couldn't take him to the hospital. He found a doctor without borders to look after them.
As you tell that story, it's clear that it stays with you. What was it like to come home after meeting those children and others, after meeting the women and the men who have been so victimized?
on top of the fact of being victims, it was just such a culture shock in that they have nothing, and yet when I ever think back, I think they seemed happier than we are, and we have so much stuff. So when I first came home the first trip, I had a huge yard sale and got rid of all the wasteful stuff that we buy and put in our homes. And then when I came back from the second trip, I immediately started doing my speeches and trying to tell my family and friends what was going on. Because prior to me going, I didn't know what was going on there either. I was totally ignorant to it. So initially, I think I was still going full speed and just talking about it. Now, I wasn't doing the interviews, but I was telling everybody about the interviews as much as I could. Maybe partly so that I didn't have to just sit quietly and think about it. As long as I kept talking about it, I was doing something. And so when I first came home, I got into that. Just
how did people react?
I mean, when I do my speech, I break up like I do every time I talk about it a little bit. So, I mean, other people would cry and say it was, you know, a wonderful presentation and it's horrible what's happening. But then way too many would walk out and that would be it. Well, that was a nice story. And so now I take, you know, copies of how to write a letter to your prime minister, how to write a letter to your MPP, you know, try and motivate them to do something. And it is frustrating for myself and other people because they always ask, you know, what can I do? And that's my only answer is to write letters. So, you know, people care, or Canadians care and show they care, but we're very ambivalent and just happy with our own little lives and don't want to really hear about that too much.
Well, and arguably we in the media don't talk about it enough.
Yeah, absolutely, because nobody wants to start their day hearing about somebody else's horrors.
You're one person, and you did do something. You stand almost as an example as how one person can make a difference.
I mean, yes, I guess, but I mean, I think part of my problem is I don't feel like I have made a difference yet because nothing's happened.
Did you write to your MPP? Did you write to the Prime Minister?
Yeah, the Prime Minister, I got a letter back telling me to go to a website to see what Canada's doing for Sudan, and my MPP sent me a form letter that was dated 3 days prior to when my letter was written. So didn't give me a lot of faith in either.
So what do you think about when you wake up in the morning?
How can we, the rest of us, walk this earth knowing it's going on and do nothing and just go about our days?
When you came home, you actually suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder. Can you talk about that?
Mm-hmm. Well, as I said, I started out doing my speech constantly, mostly to universities, high schools, rotary clubs. Usually whenever I did one speech, somebody would refer me to somebody else and I would get another speech. So I kept doing it as often as possible. I kept in touch with all three of my interpreters from both trips through email. My interpreter from my first trip, we called usually once a week or so. And then after about a month or two, I don't know what triggered it, but I just stopped. I couldn't talk about it. I couldn't keep in touch with anybody. I was pretty much miserable all the time. And I seriously thought I was losing my mind. I didn't know what was wrong. And but, I mean, I've been through enough at work that I know when you start feeling like that, you go to a counselor. So I contacted a lady who you know, just kind of went through my life history, and then as soon as I started talking about Sudan and Darfur and explained to her what I'd done, she immediately said, you have post-traumatic stress. It's absolutely classic symptoms. And just after a few sessions of doing a lot of crying and a lot of talking, and I guess just realizing I wasn't losing my mind, that it was, I guess, a way of dealing with things, that I was able to get back on my feet and start doing my speeches again. And I think doing my speeches is still part of the therapy.
Will you go back?
Yeah, I hope to go back next year. I'm trying to think positive and think that we're going to get more troops in there and they're going to put a stop to it. And then soon, like what's going on in Afghanistan, they're going to need people to go in to train the police there and, you know, hopefully make things right.
You know, as I talk to you and I see how you react emotionally to this, I think it's such a burden for you. And then on the other hand, I think for you not to be involved now would be a greater burden.
Oh, I'd break down if I didn't do something.
You're going to make me cry. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Debbie Bodkin is a sergeant with the Waterloo Regional Police. Well, that's all we have for this podcast. You can listen to The Current weekday mornings on CBC Radio 1 right after the 8:30 news, as well as on Sirius Satellite Radio 137. To find out more about our program, visit cbc.ca/thecurrent. If you have any thoughts on what you're hearing on The Current, share them with us. Send us your comments. You can email us at thecurrent, all one word, thecurrent@cbc.ca. Our mailing address is Post Office Box 500, Station A, Toronto, M5W1E6. Or call us collect 1-877-287-7366. To subscribe to other great CBC Radio podcasts, check out cbc.ca/podcasting. Thanks for listening. I'm Anna Maria Tremonti.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.